Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and the Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rothberg. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment, and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report.
Milfredo, I've been watching your Instagram. It looks like, what are you, in Manchester? Where are you calling in from?
Yeah, Manchester, yeah, good show last night. Do you remember, I just going around, man, I don't even know where I am. Newcastle, Manchester, north at the moment. Yeah, it's good.
You promised me after summer you were slowing down. When is the slowing down happening?
It doesn't happen. Well, when this show starts paying the millions and I can stop DJing and then
yay, more festivals! So what's the one you're doing
now? Got another 2 years to do then, have I?
What's this one?
It was Factory Records weekend.
Oh, what?
Do you remember, from Manchester, that whole Manchester scene. Tony Wilson and Peter Hook from New Order. They kind of set the club up after Factory. You know,
legendary. Of course.
It's a great venue, man.
Yeah,
such a venue. But it's just like, but you just got to, you know that every DJ there before you has played every record you're going to play. So you have to kind of be a bit sneaky and try and play some remixes and stuff. You don't play Blue Monday. It's just like, just get booed off. It's just like, heard it all before. So
where did you spin?
I was just doing lots of mashups, really. You know what I do, you know, just taking bits of the Mondays, bits of Joy Division, you know, nothing too battery, but anything really from that 90s scene, and just putting some different beats on it and stuff. So they won't have heard it. Do you know what I mean? I can't play anything they've heard before. So it's a bit of a poison chalice. You think, oh, great, yeah, I'm playing at Factory Records. Start looking at all your 90s tunes. You just think, yeah, these have been played a million times here.
Double-edged sword. You want to be on that bill, but you don't want to be on the bill.
Definitely. Well, I didn't get booed off, so
I'm sure you didn't.
And I'll tell you what, that Manchester crowd, they're a hard one to please too. They will boo you off, big time.
They have no problem telling you if you suck or not.
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
And you don't suck, that's why you're part of our team, Milfredo.
Thank you, mate. Yeah. I just think it's that you haven't got anyone else.
No, man. The DJ line was freaking epic. You have no idea. There was like there was loads,
a big queue.
You were the one that we were like, no, hands down, he's a legend, we'd love him, he's actually funny and good looking. Actually, your Zavatar, I can't get over your Zavatar. Oh my god,
no, I'm so still loving it. That's on all my I'm using that now for every club I play. So can you send us some press shots?
Yes,
I can.
I was just gonna say, I hear him laughing. Talk to Kevin about a hologram. We got to get a hologram going for you, Kevin. Can we get him a hologram?
Absolutely.
Oh my god,
yeah, that's moving into season 3, but we could, Milfredo could be the first one.
Yes, Kev. Does that mean I won't even have to turn up and DJ anymore? I can just send the hologram.
You can DJ in 3 places, get paid 3 times in one day.
Yeah, I'm on it. Sign me up.
Kevin, so, all right, well, you're gigging away about all this, but the shows are coming together. I'm blown away with what you're creating. Do you want to update us on the series, or
definitely, mate. It's a bit of a learning curve as well for me. I've got to be honest. You know, I had all these great ideas of what it was going to sound like and stuff. And when you start putting it together, it is a different kettle of fish. It's, you know, there's some great vocal tracks that I thought, oh man, that is going to be a dream. And you put it in, and it's just like, they're just too nosy. You know, they keep sticking their head up and spoiling the interview and stuff. Yeah, yeah, it is. And so I definitely had to, you know, change my train of thought for sure.
Well,
so,
this is the thing here. You're like used to playing for 10, 20, 50,000 people. No, you're like creating music to picture, really. It's like a visual.
To talk over as well. And I love dynamic music. Do you know what I mean? And it, as much as it needs to be a groove, you know, and that doesn't interfere with, you know, it's all about the people we're interviewing. You know, there's some massive stars we're interviewing, and, you know, to just lay a track all over them would just be sinful. So it's just, but I'm loving it. You know, it's real good.
But do you feel like sometimes, because obviously we have a lot of like, you know, songwriters coming on the show. So you're being tasked with like trying to shoehorn their music into their conversation. Is that a difficult task? Is that kind of
it can be, but you'll be surprised. Some of the stars, what they're talking about, it's amazing how often their music fits talking. Do you know what I mean? It's just weird. You know, they are, you know, they say, you know, you if people look like their dogs. Well, a lot of people talk like their music. So,
And
it really does work. And it's kind of, you know, I can't believe how often it's, I can't find anything. I know, let's try one of their tracks. And it's just like, oh my God, it works. You know, it's just the, there's something in that, definitely. But it's night and day, you know, it just gives it a life. It brings the interviews to life too. So I'm not saying you're boring, Jason, but you know.
Hey, look, I'm so, why do you think I keep bringing on all these guest hosts, man? I'm so fucking boring.
No, man. And your voice sounds great on it. It really does.
keep exciting. Telling me that. Thank you. I need warm fuzzies. Well, Kevin, look, he's being inspired and being created because of the music. When you're hearing Milfredo's Beds, is it helping you with the visuals?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every element helps to, you know, create the potent mix that we have. And so Milfredo's music and, of course, his personality and everyone's, really, Rose's and everyone that chimes in and the guests, of course, and the sync opportunities just melds
talent
together.
Show.
Hot, nice gumbo.
So, yes, mate.
Oh, it sounds delicious. So I think we should bring up Jody, who, again, I rave about Jody every show. Honestly, there's like all this. It's like that people talk about the swan on the lake, you know, where it's so graceful and looks so, and there's all this kicking going on underneath. And this is what this team does. But we look graceful because of Jody, these visuals she's created for the show.
Well, I'm laughing hysterically because graceful is not my middle name.
You make us that we're that graceful swan because of you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to do it. And things are really very, very exciting what's happening. And I'm loving it.
You sound so cool tonight. Like, are you sipping a glass of red wine and smoking one of those skinny lady cigarettes? What's happening in New Jersey?
No, just the sun is setting, the night is coming to an end, and that's where we're at today.
Well, I'm sorry that we constantly make you work in front of that computer of yours. I hope it's not distracting from your beautiful creativity, because again, everybody that we're talking to tonight is an incredible songwriter, and I hope they all continue to submit for our submissions. But let's bring up the finale. The fireworks, the glitz, the glamour, Paula Flack. Hiya, Paula.
Hi.
How's it going in London town?
Yeah, good. Freezing cold. It's really cold suddenly.
Time to cuddle up. Oh, you can't. Your man's in LA.
He's in the sunshine in California, yes.
Making deals.
He's
a movie producer now. That's so cool.
Something like that, yeah.
That's cool. And how are you? I know that you are slaving away like the rest of the team. You're managing okay? How are the kids?
I'm just about managing okay. Kids are still alive.
That's a good start.
That's the main thing, right? They're fed. Yeah. They're all in bed right now. I am very busy, actually, trying to promote the podcasts and get people to listen to them. And
how exciting. Well, I think Robert told me the numbers. We had 7 listeners.
I know. I'm so happy. I thought it was 6. So that's one more than I was told.
We hit that magic 7. I knew. Amazing. It was like, oh my God. So amazing.
So who have we got on tonight, Jason? I can't wait for you to tell me who's coming on.
Oh my God, Wilfredo, I'm so glad you asked.
It's the only reason I've come along.
Susie Quattro.
What?
Yeah. Tony Montana, our guest host. Oh my God. Great White. And like Rock Queen. Oh my God, what a show we have. What am I more excited about? Our guest co-host or our featured guest, incredible superstars, incredible talent. But before we get to that, I have to introduce my friend, Darren Feldman, who I know since actually elementary school, probably before that, but really crafted a beautiful friendship when he was one of the marketing directors for Guitar Center and is a brilliant marketing genius, someone I'm proud to call my friend and to welcome to our stage. Darren, how's it going, my friend?
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Well, you sound incredibly excited to be here.
anytime I can get together with you, even if it's virtually, it's great. I always need some of your energy and positivity.
Thank you. Honestly, Darren, so many things in my life you've helped along the way. You know, when I'm doing my charity stuff, whether it was with the David Lynch Foundation or Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the UN, you constantly brought in Guitar Center to help sponsor and make these events special. And tonight, again, you've done it. You know, you've brought in a legendary rock star to our stage. I would love for you to actually introduce our co-host tonight. This is so special tonight. I was hoping you could introduce him for us and tell us who's joining this conversation.
Absolutely. Sure. So, you know, during my time at Guitar Center, I did have the opportunity to meet and hang out with, do marketing and promotions with all kinds of different artists. And this is somebody that I've had an opportunity to maintain a great relationship with beyond that. And so here comes LA musician Tony Cardenas Montana.
Yay!
Originally from Great White, joined them in the mid-80s and toured extensively with the band. He recorded with them on kind of their pinnacle, some gold and multi-platinum selling Grammy-nominated albums, Twice Shy, which was all over the charts in the late 80s, and Hooked. He has Billboard chart writing credits on two of the big cuts, fan favorites, and one of mine, Missed a Bone, and Call It Rock and Roll. In 92, he took a step away in order to pursue other interests. He released a solo album called Tombstone Shuffle, which my favorite off that album is the song Prayer. Mm. That was in 2001. In 2008, he launched and produced Monster Circus, which was a precedent-setting stage show at the Las Vegas Hilton, set in the theater made famous by Elvis. Wow. And the show featured a host of rock stars, dancers, and acrobats, a lot of visual and aural stimulation. In 2010, he got the call to join Slash's touring band.
Yeah, wow.
And was all over Asia and Australia on that leg of the tour. I know he and I had some great conversations of his fondness of the band The Church as he was going through Australia tour. He recently has been doing a lot of work with Jack Russell's Great White, whom I've seen him with multiple times over the past few years. And his latest project is a band called Shadow and the Thrill, with a recently released album called Sugar Bowl, which has gotten a lot of online buzz and has been featured multiple times in Classic Rock magazine. Phenomenal musician and even better person, Tony Cardenas Montana.
Hey, man. Thanks, Dan.
Tony, welcome to the stage. Darren, thank you for that incredible introduction. Thank you for bringing this rock icon to our stage. I love you, my friend. You are incredible.
You're welcome, Jason.
Thanks, Darren, man.
I'm going to pass the mic now to Rose. I know you have some questions for Tony.
Yeah. Hey, Tony. Were you born and raised in LA?
Yes. Yes. I was born in Downey. Basically, I've been in the San Gabriel Valley and Orange County for my entire life here. Yeah.
Wow. And was music always a part of your life growing up? What attracted you to the music business when you were a kid?
Well, I guess my mom was kind of the more musical person, but she didn't play an instrument, but there was always music playing in the house. And she had a pretty varied taste. And I was raised on a lot of old country classics and country music, like old, you know, type, you know, country music and rock and early rock, Elvis, those kind of things. So that's kind of where I got my, that was definitely the spark. I mean, I would just wore out, you know, these Elvis records that she had. And
wow.
I just loved anything that had a good groove to it. Anything that was, you know, where the I could feel the rhythm section of the band, like, really pumping. And I just was just drawn to it. So loved that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny how, like, a certain generation, like our generation, how when we were still young, that you could go from Elvis to the Beatles in a very short period of time is too clearly what seemingly different kinds of music, but the Beatles were actually influenced by all of these people that you mentioned, as were most of the British groups. So how old were you when you learned to play the guitar?
I probably started playing as about 8. You know, I would start poking around with little, you know, any instrument that I could find around the house. And my parents purchased a piano at one point, and I started started banging on it, and it just started really teaching myself, I guess, for the most part.
And what kind of songs were you playing when you were 8 years old on the guitar?
My friend down the street had a guitar. He was taking some formal lessons, so he'd show me a couple of chords, and, you know, I learned, you know, a Beatles song here or there or whatever. But for the most part, it was all about experimentation for me, and I would literally just sit at the piano and compose chord progressions or whatever that just sounded right to me, I suppose. And I didn't really learn anything in particular. I just kind of started making stuff,
right.
You know, inventing stuff. And you know, it's kind of stuck with me to this day, really. It's like a Rubik's Cube. You pick it up and it's like, how to approach it this time.
So did you formally learn to write music, or was it a progression from playing the instrument?
I ended up deciding to study music in college, and I'd taken a couple of lessons here and there, but I really wanted to learn formally what are the notes, you know, what are the notes, and how do they relate to it? I studied in college as classical composition. I started doing that and applying that to my instrument. And as soon as I started doing that, I think I did blossom as a musician.
Yeah.
Then I ended up having my own, a bunch of students, and that's what I started doing before I got into Great White.
So I kind of asked this of actors as well. I mean, do you feel like for kids who are getting into music the way you did when you were 8 years old, do you feel that background in learning the classic form of what you do is important to the progression then to create your own voice?
I do. I'm glad I did it later. I'm glad I did it as closer to an adult. I'll never forget looking at the description of the course in college, and it said, learn to write music. And I thought, great. I'm going to go in and I'm going to learn to write the music that's in my head on a piece of paper. But that wasn't the case. They were going to teach me how to write a chord progression in the style of Bach or whatever. And that's what I learned. So I'm glad that I was able to freely associate as a young person and just be as creative as I wanted to be without any rules.
And then find the structure later in life.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
And learn to apply it. And it helped me as a professional musician to be able to communicate with other professionals.
Yeah.
So that's the language you have to have.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. Mm. What was the inspiration behind the name of your band now, Shadow and the Thrill?
You know, my partner in this, Peter Merluzzi, he's an old radiophile kind of guy.
Uh-huh.
And he loved all the old radio serials. And one of them is The Shadow. And
right.
So we both kind of gravitated towards that because it is kind of dark, and I think that's how he sees me. And so he thought I was a shadow. And then a nod to the blues great B.B. King, and The Thrill is gone. So we decided to call the band The Thrill. That's where we went off with that.
So cool. Clearly you have this amazing ear, Tony. You know music. What's a test of a good song to you?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that happened when I did join Great White was I had the real benefit and pleasure of knowing Alan Niven, who is the band's manager
right.
and producer, and his tutelage of how to approach, songwriting and musicianship and all those things is so important for me and for the rest of my career. He always would say, if you can't sit down with an acoustic guitar and a voice and bang that song out and have it make sense from A to, from soup to nuts, A to Z, then it's not really, you don't really have a song yet. And that rings true. I've seen it over and over again. And so that is my test. If there's anything that I wanted to record, and for that album, Sugar Bowl, especially, I chose songs that I felt definitely could pass that test, at least for me. So
I wanted to actually go backwards because you were a music teacher. You're still in touch with some of those students. In fact, you even write with some of these songwriters.
Yeah. One of the standouts, he was 11 years old. His name was Al Baca. And
that's his first name.
Al Baca.
And that's a great name.
And he would come in as this little kid, and 11. He definitely had a song sense. He would come in and play these little chord progressions that he would be making up. And I would be like, I'd think to myself, that's actually better than the band that I'm in right now with a bunch of, guys have been playing their whole life. So you get to see people that have a real gift. And he certainly did have a gift. And he ended up a professional touring musician, recording artist himself.
Incredible.
And we hooked up later on and, 10, 20 years later, whatever. And he's actually very helpful in me getting Shadow on the Throw off the ground. And if I bring a song to him, I'd bring him some, hey man, I think about recording this one. He listened to it and go,
he's turned into your song doctor.
Yeah, right? Yeah. He turned into my greatest critic is what he is. So,
wow.
But in a good way.
No, I had to. I think that's so beautiful that, you're still connected and that relationship has transformed in this collaborational relationship. It's just, I think, very inspirational. The way that your name came up between Darren and I is he actually brought you in to score a new jingle for the company he works for. So I was like, that was when it all clicked. I'm like, oh, this is what we talk about, film, music. I'm just wondering, have you ever participated in music to scene or have you thought about scoring a film? Is that an inspiration at all?
Absolutely. In fact, going back to it as being a child and just making up music on the piano, I'm composing, right? I didn't realize it, but I would go to a family get together and they say, Anthony knows how to play piano for everybody. So I'd play one of these inventions, right? And people would go, that sounds like a movie. It sounds like movie music. They would say that to me all the time because they didn't know this, they didn't know what it was, right? So, yes, I would love to do that. And I've done a little bit of experimentation there, and I've been asked to maybe do like almost an audition where you write a piece of music to a scene. And that really does fascinate me. And the work that I have done for Darren is just so, it's so fun and fresh in that, here's somebody that's asking you for giving you words, that describe what a piece of music should feel like or how it's supposed to add something to a visual or to whatever, a commercial. And to be able to take that and translate it and make it into music that is just so fun. It's so creative. I had so much fun doing it.
It does. It seems like a natural. The more that I'm listening with Lisa to your music, your solo stuff, it just seems it could drive scenes so well. In fact, I was listening to Sugar Bowl. Can you tell us a little bit about Sugar Bowl?
Right on. Sugar Bowl is an actual artifact of my first marriage. It's the first artifact that we purchased as a couple. And I thought it was a great metaphor for a relationship, love, or a broken relationship as a broken sugar bowl, right? So, yeah, I wrote that song based, it's more as an acoustic piece, but boy, once my drummer and my partner, recording partner, Brent Arsement, played drums to it, it really became a heavier, more Hendrix-y kind of approach. Yeah. And yeah, it's a good story. It's a good story, and it made for a great song, I think.
Now, I couldn't agree more on it. Exactly. It's that story and why I feel it's this word sinkable we keep hearing.
I did have one question. This is Kevin. And my question is, I mean, all your music is so dynamic and it's incredible. I really love that crazy cover. It was crazy. Yeah. And so I always like to hear inspirations from filmmakers, from musicians, from anyone that inspires me, because that your music inspired me. Inspirations, both when you first started and then what inspires you now.
If thinking about a little kid that's listening to Elvis, right? Like listening to the groove of that music. I don't know if it's just it's obviously a emotional thing. It's a psychological thing. It's a actual kinetic thing. It's like it makes me want to move. It makes me want to bounce around. Right. Like, I think that's just that physicality of rock music is what really got me. And then, you know, all the other kind of music is, you know, it's intellectually stimulating. I listen a lot of classical music as a kid too. And my mom just shoved it down my throat. So all those things I think are, it's an intellectual and psychological, you know, soup that just, I don't know. It gave me a way to try to communicate. And that's, yeah, it's another word that Susie used as well, is to communicate. And that's, I think that at the end of the day, and I think it's probably the same with in any art, right? Any a filmmaker or an artist, you know, brush to canvas, you know, music to recorder. It's trying to communicate, right? You want to see who else gets it. And if they get it, then it makes that little piece of you feel like you're connected, like you're not from another planet.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, God knows I feel like that a lot. So.
Oh my God. I think we just got the sound bite of the show. That was beautiful.
That was great. Absolutely.
Wow. That was really good.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to get it out there and to, you know, that's wonderful.
It's our pleasure. Are you kidding? You make us look good. I think we should bring Paul up and find out who we're all here to torture tonight.
We're glad you're here. So grab a drink. Let's have a conversation about music and sing. Uh-huh.
Okay, Paula Flack, our producer, marketing director, overall genius. Welcome back. Tell us who we have in the hot chair tonight.
Thanks, Jason. I'm glad to be back. Tonight, we have got Susie Quattro on the show.
Oh, my God.
She is a rock legend, bass player, singer, songwriter, TV star, actress, poet, radio show host. Susie has released 18 albums and sold 55 million records in a music career that spans 5 decades. Her latest album is called The Devil in Me, and she co-wrote it with her son, Richard Tuckey, during the first lockdown and released it in 2021. Susie has influenced many female musicians such as Joan Jett, Chrissy Hynde, Kathy Valentine, who's the bass player for the Go-Go's, indie rock band Tuscadero, and Scottish singer-songwriter Katie Tunstall. She's well known for her international rock mega hits, Can the Can and Devil Gate Drive, and other top 10 hits, 48 Crash, The Wild One, and If You Can't Give Me Love, but also for her acting career, in particular, playing Leather Tuscadero, very cool, in Happy Days, which I loved watching as a kid, although she's also appeared in hit British TV shows, including Minder, Midsummer Murders, and Dempsey and Makepeace, classic TV. Susie hosted her own radio show on BBC Radio 2 for 15 years, starred in several London West End musicals, including as Annie Oakley in Annie Get Your Gun. In 2019, she had a biographical documentary released called Susie Q, which was acclaimed by Billboard, Rolling Stone, Golden Globes, and Variety magazines. And she's now set to have a biopic made of her life story. About time is all I can say. She has received many awards, including being inducted into the Michigan Rock and Roll Legends Hall of Fame, and has received an honorary doctorate in music from Cambridge University. And now Susie is joining us on the Sync Report. Welcome, Susie.
Thank you. Thank you. It's nice to be here. That was a hell of an introduction. God, I hope I can live up to all that.
Of course you can.
honestly, Susie, she's a pioneer for women in rock, and just overall, the amount of music this woman's created in her career is staggering. Bass player, singer, songwriter, actress, DJ. Oh my God. Susie, let's get this conversation started.
I'm ready.
All right, me too. I've been looking forward to this all week long. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. I think you were on the red eye last night coming back from Germany, and you're in the UK now. How was that? Something special for New Year's is cooking?
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, my husband, who I've been with for 28 years now, we live in separate countries, and I can recommend it. He lives in Hamburg. Yeah, he lives in Hamburg. I live in the UK, and before COVID, of course, we just went back and forth whenever we felt like it. Of course, it was much more difficult during that. Oh, yeah. But now I was there doing a big on the main station, ARD, New Year's Eve, 4-hour New Year's Eve show. So it was a long day. I was there from 11 o'clock until midnight the following that evening. Yeah, that's a long day.
Oh, my God. And you're here with us. Thank you for not sleeping through the interview. I'm sure you need some rest. So before there's so much to cover, Susie. So let's start back at the earliest moments. The world knows you're born in Detroit, Michigan, which is like the coolest city for music, cars. You know, what was happening as you were coming up was just such a pivotal time in music. But please give us just some insight to what was the family like. You're from a big family. Obviously, it's like, I know all of your sisters are musicians. What was it like growing up in that household?
It was quite something. It's five kids, you know, and my father played his whole life too. So he was a multi-instrumentalist, and he gave all four daughters and his son any music lesson we wanted. So I actually read and write and play classical piano and percussion. Those are my two taught instruments. And then I taught myself bass when we started the band. But it was a great learning process to, you know, we did family shows and you had to stand up and do a sketch and do a dance and do a song and do a this and do that. And, you know, you can't get better training if you're going to be an entertainer.
So what was this for, like family holidays or something that you guys would put on shows for you, or just for any reason?
Any excuse. And we were up there, and I was the one that you had to get the hook to pull me off.
I love it. You were a born star. Incredible. Oh,
I love entertaining, and it's just in my blood, you know, and it's I've been like that since a little girl.
So when you were a little girl, what artists inspired you?
Well, I have to go right back to 1956. I was 5 and a half. And it was, you know, everybody has in their life light bulb moments. And at 5 and a half, I had one. And I'm not embellishing this story. This is exactly what happened. We were watching, and any American knows this, of my age group, the Ed Sullivan Show. It was staple Sunday night viewing for all American families. The whole family stopped, 8 o'clock, sit down in front of the TV. It was a variety show. So we're watching. And at the end, all five kids are there. And at the end, Ed Sullivan would always bring on something for the youngsters, as he used to like to say. And right. on comes Elvis Presley. Oh, now, man. I'm only 5 and a half, okay? He starts to sing Don't Be Cruel. My eldest sister, by 9 years, starts to scream. So I'm looking at her thinking, what is the matter with you? Why are you screaming? Then I turned and I watched the screen. I sort of dove into the screen somehow. I went into it and light bulb moment. I'm going to do that.
At 5 years old.
At 5 and a half. Yes. And that never left me.
What Elvis did for music and rock and roll, you've done. You became this thing that you saw that you wanted to be. You broke down all of these walls, but I'm jumping ahead. Something you said actually a moment ago, which I didn't realize until we started doing the research with Lisa, is that your first instrument that you were playing was bongos. And I think you were actually, you know, at the age 7 and 8 years old, you're playing with your father's band. How were you attracted to that instrument? And what was the progression behind that?
I always was more a percussive type person. Piano is a percussion instrument. I used to put rubber bands on a broomstick and pluck it like a stand-up bass guitar. I played the bongo drums. I actually, at 7, wanted to go into coffee shops with my bongos and recite poetry.
Oh, you beat Nick at heart. I love it.
Oh, my God almighty. And my dad took me sometimes on a Sunday instead of going to church. My mother never knew. And he would take me to his gig instead. And he'd let me sit in front of the band and play. Fantastic.
Unbelievable. And I'm sure that audience, they started coming just to see you. Incredible. I can't even imagine what that was like. And so you move from bongos, I guess, you know, a couple of years later, your dad actually buys you a Fender bass. Do you still have this bass? What was it like going from the bongos to the bass?
Well, I went from bongos to classical piano, and I took that for quite a long time. Yeah. And then I also joined the orchestra at school, and I got first chair percussion. So then at 14, we decided, after seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, we called a couple of girlfriends of ours who were also sisters. This is me and Patty, the one next to me in age, and another girl whose dad was in my dad's band, and we decided to form a group, and an all girl group, and everybody spoke up real quick. Oh, I want the guitar. I want the bass. I want this. I want that. And I said, hello. What am I going to play? I didn't speak up for some reason, which is unlike. And my elder sister said to me, you're playing bass. So I said, okay. I didn't care. And I went to my dad, who had every instrument you could imagine in the house. We had every instrument. You can't name one we didn't have. And I said, Dad, we're starting a band. Do you have a bass guitar? And he said, sure. And he gave me, for my first bass guitar, 1957 Fender Precision with a basement amp, gold scratch plate. I know. And when I tell other musicians this, they want to shoot me.
Out of jealousy. Well, I can hear Tony moaning in the background. Oh, so yeah. You definitely hit a nerve.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? The funny thing is, Alice Cooper says it in my documentary. Why didn't she get a smaller bass? I mean, it made me laugh when he said that, because I didn't question what my father gave me to learn on. I said, do you have a bass? And that's what he gave me. I didn't know they had smaller basses. I didn't know they had smaller necks. I just thought, okay, here's what I learned. So consequently, I'm a seriously good bass player.
You are such a good bass player. Actually, there's one more story connected to your father I was hoping you could tell me. You first get your driver's license. And, you know, again, you're in Motor City growing up, which I could only imagine, like, graduation. You know, some of these things are like monumental moments for us growing up. But probably your first time driving a car was at that caliber. And you hear a song on the radio. Can you illuminate that story
yes.
for us?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah. I passed the first time. I took my test in my dad's Cadillac. So I passed the driving test, passed the written, and I got my license. I was able to drive on my birthday. And my dad said, okay, Susie, you can pick me up at the bus stop after work today. I was flying. I was driving the Cadillac by myself. I switched on the radio when I got in the car, switched on the radio, ready to make the drive down to the corner. And it went, sunshine came softly through my window today. Window
today. Well, I got to tell you, Donovan does send his love, and he has such fond memories of you, and he absolutely adores you. I couldn't get off the phone with him when I told him I was talking to you.
I adore him, too, and he... I gave him the biggest laugh of his life because I sang on one of his, before I made it, I was in the studio and I sang on one of his records. I was a huge Donovan fan. And I confessed to him that I was the idiot who scraped the banana peel and smoked it. And he said, Susie, that was a joke. I said, well, I tried it.
And so did so many others. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that.
How dumb can you be, you know?
But you're absorbing all this amazing music. And obviously, I want to talk about Mickey Most in a minute. But you're in these bands at such a young age and you're playing a lot of covers. What were some of your favorite artists to cover at that time?
Well, I was Susie Soul at the time. I was really into Otis Redding. So all my big showstoppers were things like Try a Little Tenderness and I've Been Loving You Too Long and anything ballsy I had to do. I sang 99.9% of the songs. They didn't give me the female stuff. They gave me the ballsy stuff. So I was up there. I was up there strutting my stuff very young. Very, very young. Yeah.
So ballsy and so beautiful and so strong.
My father, you know, he's been a musician all his life. And that's, I actually, one of my series on the radio was Quadrophonic. And I had one thing called My Dad's Songbook of all the songs that were taken from that era and made into rock hits and pop hits, you know. And that was one of them. And I announced it. And it did used to go in my dad's day. Oh, she may be weary. Children do get weary wearing that same shabby dress, like that. Right. And I announced it. I announced it, went into the song. My dad went, what the hell? What did you do to that song? I said, well, Otis made it a hit, Dad, you know?
Oh, my God. Incredible. Incredible. Well, again, you know, looking through perspective, it's so interesting looking backwards. You know, you have, again, I was saying earlier, the walls that you've broken down for women in rock. It just, you know, again, I think you kind of, you know, might have had blinders like that 5-year-old kid watching Elvis, you know, thinking you why not? Why can't you be that, male or female? It doesn't matter. So, but I was just wondering, you know, with the misogyny, with the, you know, the fact that you were kind of the first doing this, was there any other females that, I don't know, that you looked at that could be a mentor or inspiration to keep you strong and focused?
I didn't really have a blueprint, and there was no guarantee I was going to make it. I knew what I was doing was different, but I didn't care. And I used to look at certain other girls and go, oh, I like that. Maybe I should do a little bit of that, or maybe I should do a little bit of that. It always would come to the same conclusion. I have to be exactly who I am. Whatever this is, you know, whatever this is, if I'm not this person, I don't want to make it as somebody else. And in fact, Mickey Most, I can feel him around me. When he came to see me in the band Cradle, which was my second all-girl band, he called his wife. I didn't know this till I got to England. He called his wife right after he had seen the act. He only wanted me. It was my second offer. The first was from Elektra Records. They saw the band. They only wanted me. Mickey saw the band, only wanted me. He called his wife from New York. He called her, and it was, you know, middle of the night here. And he said, I found it. I found it at last. I found it. And she said, what? And he said, I don't know, but I found it. And that's the best explanation of me that I can give you. I don't know, but I found it.
Incredible. Another friend of yours and Donovan's, I got to just ask about Alice Cooper, the great, the legend, Alice Cooper. Early in your career, he brought you on to open for him. What was that relationship like? And do you feel that, did that tour help you to actually pursue and do what you wanted to do?
Well, I was already having big, huge hits everywhere in the world. I started the tour America in 74. And by the time I went to America with my English band, I'd already had 4 massive hits everywhere.
Incredible.
And there was a little bit of time lapse there that the records that were hitting everywhere else didn't quite didn't translate over to America. I don't know why, but I was asked to go on and open up for Alice's Welcome to My Nightmare tour. And we had Your Mama Won't Like Me. That album was out right then. So yeah, that helped on that. It was 85 shows. And we had done 20 shows of our own before that. And came straight back from Alice's tour and went over to Australia and Japan.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable. And when I hear these people today complaining that they work hard, you don't know what working hard is.
No. Well, this is absolutely incredible.
You asked me about Alice. We've known each other since I've been 15. We're good friends.
Lucky schmo.
Yeah, we are good friends. We've always been close. We've always had a very friendly attraction for each other and a very healthy respect for each other. And I just love the guy. You know, we're good friends. We always have been.
You know, I've had a chance to meet him a few times, and there is not actually a kinder, more humble character in the world. I mean, with all this man's success, he's just such a huge heart.
I gave him a black eye. That's a good story. On that tour.
A black eye? I thought it was a kiss. I didn't know it was a black eye.
Oh, no, we did kiss.
I heard that rumor.
We did kiss, and it was one of those, you know, we all had them. We liked each other. We were attracted to each other. We found ourselves alone. We kissed, and it was one of those kisses that could have gone one way or the other way. And we had that kiss, and we just looked at each other. We went, nah, we're going to stay friends. And we did. And I think he regrets that because every time I see him, he mentions it.
Of course.
So anyway.
Of course he regrets it. Oh, my God. I'm kicking him all the way from Ireland.
Nice.
We were on that tour, and it was forever. And, of course, you get bored and a little bit crazy when you're on the road that long. And we decided to have a pellet gun, you know, those little rubber tip darts, you know, that you can.
Oh, God.
So, we decided to have a battle. So,
God,
we got serious. We took mattresses out in the hallway, and we were binging and bonging and banging. And I am a good shot. So Alice was hiding behind the television. He didn't think I could see him, but I could. And he unfortunately poked his nose out, and he's got quite a big nose. So he poked his nose out, and I went splat, black eye. And then he wore my T-shirt on stage that night out of respect.
Oh, God, I love it. Oh, he's my hero again. I can't believe we have you on this show. Susie, you are such a rock star. All right, I'm going to unleash Rose Ganguza, the godmother of indie film, my hero, actually, and the woman that actually makes us all look professional. Rose, you want to take over?
He's always too kind, Susie. You brought me back my youth, Susie. I mean, the two most seminal moments, thinking back into, you know, our youth was Elvis Presley on Ed Sullivan and the Beatles in 1964. I mean, both of them were just such seminal moments. And how we used to watch that show every week, of all the acts that he presented, those two really stand out. So we're going to go into your on-camera life now. Tell me a little bit about working with Gary Marshall and Happy Days and how that all came about.
Sure. I was lucky enough to get Gary on my documentary before he passed away. I'm so pleased he was on there. Yeah, fantastic.
How wonderful.
Yeah. I was in Japan on tour. I was always over there. Like, I think I did 15 tours there so far. They even have a sake named after me. And I'm normal size. I'm normal size there. All the clothes fit. Anyway, I was there on tour, and I got a call from my American press agent, who now works for Alice, actually, Toby Mamus. And he said, there's this show here. They would like you to come and audition for the part. I didn't know the show, but he said, believe me, you want to do it. I said, okay, because I always wanted to try acting anyway. I knew I could do it. So I flew over and of course I went to read, and I had on my normal clothes, which were my street leathers. I have stage leathers and street leathers. And Gary Marshall came up to me and he said, hi. I said, hi. He said, how clever of you to dress in the role. And I said, what the hell are you talking about? Yeah, really. What are you talking? He said, well, she's called Leather Tuscadero. I said, well, like, I knew that, you know. Anyway, so I got the role, and here's a funny one. I met the fans, I met the director, I met everybody, read for the part, and they said, go back to your hotel, and we'll give you a call. We have to discuss you. Now, I have about 11 Elvis epiphanies, and it's, you can't make this stuff up. You just can't make it up. This is one of them. And I'd have to tell you the whole thing, but this one was quite something. I'm back at my hotel. I turn on the TV. I'm waiting for the phone to ring. The phone rings. And they tell me, we want you for three years, you know, three yearly episodes. So I said, oh, great. So three seasons. And I was all excited. I was on the phone excited. And at that exact moment that they're telling me this news, the TV flashed and it said, news flash, the king is dead.
Oh, wow.
And I get a chill every time I tell that story because you can't make this stuff up.
No.
Wow.
And then when I got back, real quickly, when I got back to film my first episodes about 2 months later, they bring over this guy. And I think Jerry Paris brought him over, the director. And he said, Susie, I'd like you to meet Nudie. He's going to be making your clothes for the show. I said, okay. He was Elvis's personal designer.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, from that first, I know, from that first moment, 5 and a half years old, I tell you what, Elvis sat on my shoulder my entire career.
Incredible.
Wow. Yeah. That's pretty amazing. Were you able to play your own music on the show?
Yes, sure. In fact, I had complete carte blanche. I even wrote a song called Believe, which was, I played at the piano in the Cunningham House when Richie almost died on his motorcycle. They asked me to compose a piece for that, which I did. I played on there. God, what did I do? I did Devil Gate Drive. I did I May Be Too Young. I did a couple of Chuck Berry. Oh, God, I can't remember everything I did. But they let me do whatever I wanted to do musically.
But obviously, your presence on the show was much more appreciated than initially conceived because you wound up doing 7 episodes, right, between 1977 and 1979?
Yes. I would have done more, but I was always on the road, you know? So they had to try to get me in there. And then finally, the decision was taken without me knowing about it because Stumbling In was in the charts. I was having big hits. I mean, that was huge in America, million seller. And they didn't want my role as Leather Tuscadero to confuse people with me as Susie Quattro. And then they did actually offer me a spinoff series as well, which I turned down because I thought, I've given it 3 seasons. People know who Leather Tuscadero was. I don't need to do any more of that.
Yeah. But it also did help you to expand your audience in the U.S., right, Susie?
Yeah, sure. Sure it did. That was a number one show.
So it was huge.
Plus,
I mean, if you're going to do it, like, do it with the nicest man in the business, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, the funny thing is America is the only place in the entire planet that they say Leather Tuscadero was played by Susie Quattro. Everywhere else, they say, Susie Quattro, didn't she do a TV show?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. However you got to know me, you got to know me. So you discovered me through Leather Tuscadero, but it's through me leather. Anyway. So it's, yeah. So it's fine.
So amazing. So she became like your alter ego.
And nowadays, it's like would be an A&R's or manager's dream, you know, to all these different platforms to be able to introduce an artist. So, I mean, you were doing it before anyone even thought about that.
I'm one of these, I just, my excuse is I'm an artiste. I have to create and I have to communicate and I have to entertain. Those are my three key phrases. During lockdown, we wrote and produced and released that The Devil in Me. I wrote 2 books, wrote them and released them. One is a lyric book and the other one is based on my Instagram site. I've now just completed my 2nd poetry book. I've got 51 poems ready to go. I cannot stop creating. It's something in me. I can't help it. I've always got something to say. I'm writing a song or I'm writing a poem or I'm an artiste. That's all.
God bless you. Susie, you did something that I'm a big theater person, especially musical theater. And I was so excited when I heard that you had played Annie Oakley in Annie Get Your Gun in the London version in 1986. Tell us a little bit about the transition from obviously being a girl musician and then doing something a little bit more structured like musical theater. What was that like for you?
I try not to take on what I can't do, but I knew I could do musical theater, especially with my background of, you know, nothing but showbiz. So, and it was a good role for me, you know, a sharpshooting girl, a little bit of a tomboy. So perfect role for me. I had to learn a little bit of stillness, you know, that you gather your energy in a different way. And I had to learn to do a warm up before every show because you can't hide behind a couple of rock and roll songs. You are exposed.
Exactly. So,
but I loved it. I loved musical theater. I would dearly love to do it again. I took to it like a duck to water.
Yeah, and that Annie Oakley, you know, judging from your personality, what I can feel in the mic, just a perfect role. Really, I can just even imagine it. Then you turned your autobiography into a one-woman stage show, which ran for 2 weeks at the Hippodrome in London. How was that?
Oh, I loved it. It's so strange. I had an accident in 2014. I broke my right knee and my left wrist just for extra fun. Yeah, getting onto an airplane. I went down like a ton of bricks. Anyway, I missed an award show in Detroit. And of course, I had to cancel everything. I was 5 months laid up. But they had offered me anything I want to do at the Hippodrome for 2 weeks. And I said, I've always wanted to do a one-woman show. And while I was recuperating, I wrote the show. And that was fantastic. Oh, it was just great. I had a little trio on stage and I played the bongos on stage and I played the piano and I talked you through my life. In fact, Andrew Lloyd Webber, who's a good friend of mine, he came to the London show and we did the BBC, put it on at the BBC theater. And they never had so many requests for tickets. And Andrew came to that and he actually asked me, which I took as a compliment, came backstage afterwards and he said, "Will you ad-libbing or is that scripted?" I said, "That is a compliment." Yeah. That is a compliment.
Yeah. Really, very much so. And, you know, those kind of shows, I mean, people just really gyrate to them because they feel they're getting the real you. And because you're kind of naked on the stage, you know, it's a very funny thing. But the relationship with the audience is very important. And you already have that in spades. So it must have been incredible.
It was a very intimate, it's like you were sitting in my living room and I was talking to you. That's what it felt like. And yeah. I really enjoy, I will put that show on again. I definitely will. I love doing it. It was fun to write. Just gave me a chance to show everything that I can do, show all the instruments I can play, show my acting skills, tell my story, and just be communicating.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I'm like so curious because me and like five other people, including you, know who Tallulah Bankhead was, and you decided to write a musical about her, which I'm so fascinated by the story behind this. Tallulah who, and you also performed on the stage with this musical in 1991. Tell us a little bit about that. And how were you inspired to do this?
I saw her years ago, I think right when she was towards the end of her life on the Merv Griffin show. And I was fascinated by her, fascinated. Yeah. And I was kind of hanging around the house and all that. I thought, I would love to use my musical knowledge and write a musical. Who could I do? Tallulah Bankhead. And what drew me to her was that she was before her time. Hello, spot the similarity. Before her time, she was one of the first stars. You know what I mean? One of the first theater stars. And she had a bunch of gallery girls, they called them, who were gay, and they were up in the rafters all the time.
Yeah.
And I got the feeling reading about her that nobody knew her. And I tried to peel away the layers, you know?
Wow.
Oh, boy. And I couldn't get rid of her. After playing her, it was hard for me to get rid of her. She really stayed in me.
She was kind of the personification of broad before we even knew what broad meant.
Yeah, she was. She was, and she was just a one-off. And I wanted to get into her psyche. That's why I tried to figure out who she was. And there's a great song at the end of the show called "Mild Case of the Blues" that she just falls to pieces.
Wow.
And I tell you what, we didn't allow the press in. They came in anyway, and they snuck in. And I have reviews upstairs in my book, and it said, "A performance worth applauding." They gave me such critics.
Wow.
Really?
When I act, I don't act. I'm afraid I become.
Yeah. Well,
that's the magic.
So, Susie, in 2019, you had a documentary made by an Australian filmmaker called Susie Q about your life. How did this all come about and how heavily involved were you in the actual production of the documentary?
Totally involved. He contacted me and told me he was interested in doing a documentary about me. And I tell the story because it makes me laugh. So we're on the phone and he says, "I just got to tell you first off, Susie, I'm not a fan." I went, "Oh, okay." interesting. That's yeah, interesting. Uh-huh. That's, you know, that's really a nice icebreaker. And I said, okay. And he said, not that I don't love your music, I do, but I'm not a fan. I said, well, that's not a problem whatsoever. I said, can I ask you why you want to do this documentary about me? Right. And he said, because I saw you on a talk show and you absolutely fascinated me. And I thought to myself, okay, this is the right guy to do my story. Right. This is the right guy. And the only thing I laid down, I said, okay, let's do it. I have scissors because it's my life, but I promise you, no matter how awkward certain things might be, if it's the truth, it stays in. And I stuck to that. And all my awkward moments where I wanted to crawl on all fours and go out of the theater, they're the best moments in the film. So everybody loves the documentary because it is warts and all. And you really right. do. You get to see the struggle. You know what I mean? I did it because I wanted to put the record straight. And that's what I did.
What are the moments that are moments in the film that you think are particularly telling in terms of how you want to portray yourself to the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, I did everything. Everything that's in there is fine. It was just some bits are hard to do. You know, if people haven't seen it, they won't know. But there's a Thanksgiving tape thing that was really hard to talk about. That was difficult. A lot of the family things, it brings it back and it hurts you again, you know. So, but it's so funny. Every cringe moment, I love it now. I cry every time I watch the film. I'll tell you a funny story. I went to the London opening, the London premiere, and you go in there. It was at the Regent Theater. And, you know, you go up at the end and you do question and answer. So I wanted to see the documentary with an audience. That's how you really judge something, with an audience. So I snuck in on the side and I watched it. A couple people saw me and I went, shh, 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 you know, and they didn't say anything. So I watched it. I cried through the whole documentary. And the next day, I called my friend Cherie Curry from The Runaways. And I said, I have to tell you something. She said, what? I said, well, I went to my premiere last night. She said, yes. And I realized something. And she said, what? And I said, well, by me doing what I did, I gave permission to women all over the world to be different. And there was a long silence. And she went, and you just got that? And that really, she did it with perfect comedy timing. And you just got that. I said, yes. But isn't that refreshing? Isn't that refreshing? Yeah. Because I didn't have an agenda.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just doing it.
Yeah. So, Susie, if somebody were to come to you and say they wanted to do a feature film about your life, who's the actress you would think could actually play you?
Ooh,
that's so hard. I think maybe we're going to have to go for an unknown. I've told everybody that I'm involved with, and I can't explain it any better than this. Whatever it is that I've got, whatever that is, that thing is, it can't be acted. I have a vibe, and I know I have a vibe. So when I meet who's ever going to play me, they have to have that vibe. It's nothing you can act. It's got to be there.
Nobody can be Susie Quattro. I'm sorry. It can't be done.
Well, Susie, you're going to be featured in a new movie by one of my favorite filmmakers, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Susie, do you even realize one of your songs in Licorice Pizza?
It's called Stumbling In.
Oh, God. It's huge. 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 That sold a million in America. And that's one of my evergreens that people love to hear me sing still. What a good song.
Yeah. And Paul Thomas Anderson is just like one of the best filmmakers on earth.
Right.
I mean, he is. One of the things that Paul Thomas Anderson is known for are his soundtracks. And
Good.
He has amazing taste in music. Yeah. So he obviously has good taste to have chosen one of your tracks.
Yeah. Good for him.
I'm going to hand this over now to Tony for his set of questions, but good luck with everything. It was lovely meeting you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rose. And yes, let's get Tony back to the microphone, of course, from Great White. He's an incredible songwriter, performer, and one of the, honestly, Susie's one of the nicest guys I've actually had a chance to meet recently. Tony, why don't you go ahead and take it away?
I've been looking forward to this. Susie, I'll have to say that one of my first exposures to you was a video that you did that predates MTV and all that stuff, and that was for Lipstick.
Oh, my God. It did predate it. Isn't it strange?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good video, that. Good video.
It's a great video. And you're playing, and your band is playing, one of my favorite guitar manufacturers back from that era, too. It was BC Rich. And
Yeah,
you had a BC Rich bass with your name on the fretboard.
I know. I still have that.
You
I
do.
Still have that.
Oh, yeah. Nice. That's
I will. I won't get rid of that one. It's a good bass, and we were sponsored by BC Rich for a while, so it was nice. Yeah.
Such a cool look with everything and the leather and those instruments were just indelible for me. So, tell me a little bit about some of the recent music. What's the story behind Going Down Blues on the 2019 album No Control?
Well, I don't usually write fiction, so it's about somebody who's made me angry for a long, long time.
It sounds a little angry.
Yeah. And you know, if the shoe fits. So I'm the kind of person that I believe you turn all negatives into positives by making them works of art. So that's what I did with that. The Going Down Blues. It's not me going down, you know. And you know, most people, when they're not good people, they get caught in their own bullshit.
Such brilliance.
Now, tell us a little bit more about that album and No Control. Any favorites of yours that really, really still resonate with you?
I love the title track. And there's a great video on YouTube with that one, No Soul, No Control. This album was the first time my son and I worked together, which came out of nowhere. He's always been in bands since he's been 14. And it came up to me about maybe 3 years ago now or 4 years ago. And he said, I want to write with you. And he showed me a couple things. And I said, you're not quite ready. And then he came back and he said, I have to write with you now. And I went, oh, okay. So that meant he was ready. He showed me a few little things, you know, that he had. I said, yes, I can work with that. We went in, we started to make some demos, and third demo in, I turned to the engineer and Richard and I said, we are making an album. They said, yes, we know. And we're now two albums. And so he's turned out to be, what a talent. I never saw it coming.
Chip,
I mean,
he's the old block right there, huh?
But I didn't know he was so damn good. I would have been nicer to him, you know.
You know, you gotta be firm. You have to make sure that they really want it.
Yeah,
they really want it.
He really wanted it. He came so much so on the first album. I'm jumping a little bit, but he found his confidence on that because everybody talked about him. So on the second album, which we did together, The Devil and Me, he had found his feet. And so much so that he annoyed me, which is good. You know, he's telling me what to do. And I'm thinking, what? But, you know, when he did make an issue of something, I have to say 99.9% of the time he was correct. So I started to trust him more and more and more, you know.
So awesome.
And now, we have actually been compared to Chin and Chapman in one of the reviews. I mean, I never had reviews in my entire career like I got for The Devil and Me for the album. I never had that good of reviews anywhere. It just, the critics loved it. And Richard is just beyond himself happy, you know. And he called me and he said to me, thank you for releasing me. I know, but he released himself. I said, Richard, you have the talent. I said, you've got it. Just fly with it.
That's wonderful. So The Devil and Me, talk a little bit about, a little more about the songwriting process. How did you come to write like Queenie? I like Betty Who. Betty Who.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
From my favorites. So far.
Well, I mean, it goes back and forth. Sometimes I start it. Sometimes he starts it. Richard is very much a riff kind of guy, so he'll often play a riff to me and say, "What do you think?" And I'll take it away, play the bass to it, start singing, try the lyrics, this and that, and this and that. Betty Who. He had the riff and the title. And I said, well, what's Betty Who? And he was working for Biba Doobie. And he said, we have a tour bus and it's called Betty Who. So I thought, okay. I took that song away and I thought, wait a minute. Betty Who is a groupie. it's more like Betty Who.
Did you want to mention the European wife or your father was involved with Happy Days?
Yeah, I was exposed to that song. Of course, I mean, everybody knows that song here because it was a huge hit. But I didn't know the gentleman that was Chris Norman, the guy that sang with you and the band that he was from, which is kind of more of a European, they had a lot more European success, the band Smoke.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
My ex is actually from Poland. And so she knew all that stuff. And she exposed me to that guy. He's amazing. That guy, what a crazy, wonderful voice that guy has. So I love that. And I actually got to, as a young kid, got to tour Paramount, and I actually got to go to the Happy Days on the set, actually walk down those stairs, you know, and
fun. Yeah.
This is indelible. And your part in that series was, it brought what I wanted to see in the Happy Days. I wanted that rock and roll into it. You know,
it brought a different element in there. And I found out when I went back to see everybody a few years after I'd stopped doing it. I went back to the Paramount lot and said hello to everybody. And I was told by the lady in the office that I had the second most fan mail after the Fonz, which I never knew. Wow. Incredible. So I guess everybody liked my character.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
That was such cool stuff, man. Such cool stuff.
Hey, Jason, I just had one question for Tony, if that's all right.
Oh, good, good.
Hey, Tony, it's Milfredo here. Hope you're well.
Hey, man, thanks.
You mentioned earlier about like going to college to do what you thought was going to teach you how to write these amazing hits and stuff. And then you kind of only released your kind of inner creative when you stepped away from that. And yet you just mentioned as well that you kind of do some music teaching yourself. You know, where's that kind of, you know, for me, a lot of the new rock bands, you know, some of them are classically trained and it's, I find it all sometimes a bit, you know, rock by numbers. Right. And I just wondered how that sat with you. You know, you went to college and said, you know, this isn't for me. And then you became a music teacher. So how do you balance that kind of letting them be creative and kind of steering them? Is that a difficult thing to do for you or?
You know, it's funny. It is, because you want like I'll use my friend Al as an example. This little guy would come in and he would bring these little songs, little chord regressions that he was just making up, you know, just totally creative, right? Like with no no help, no, you know, just a kid, right? And so I would his guitar teacher, so I had to try to give him some kind of form and foundation, right? So he would come and he would record these things, record these lessons on a little cassette tape, and I would say, okay, that's great. I love what you just played. I need to step out for a second. I want you to practice your A minor, you know, scale. Don't forget your A minor. And to this day, this is our joke between us. So he's like, okay. And so you hear the door close and you hear like maybe five notes of the A minor scale. Yeah. And then he starts goofing off again and writing his music. So you can't contain that kind of creativity. Just like what Susie was just saying, she just can't not do it.
So yeah, good. Good.
There
yeah,
it is. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, yeah. No matter what foundation, it's good to have the foundation, but
so you're steering but not driving.
Absolutely. That's a great way to say.
Nice. Okay, man. Thank you. Thanks for that. Cheers, man.
Hey, I'm glad you said that, actually, Milfredo, because I was going to weigh in. It was like, not everybody is born with natural talent. You know, it's like, yeah, for those, it's funny because like when Donovan speaks to Estrella, you know, oh, you should never get schooling and you don't want to be in that box. Yeah, and that's great. You know, when you actually are born, blessed, but you know, like schmoes like me, you know, God, I could at best I bang out, you know, what's on the paper, you know, I could never create like you do. So it's, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Alfredo. That's a great point.
No, good. Thank you, Tony. Cheers, mate.
Tony, that was incredible. Susie, thank you. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. This has been an incredible journey. I know everyone's going to flip when they hear our show tonight. Thank you.
Thanks, Susie. It was a lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye.
Oh, what an angel. Seek opportunities.
Seek opportunities. It's great to have the team here. I see other people coming in now, and I want to now introduce you to what we are doing today. It's very exciting. Medhat Anbali is a composer, and we are pleased to have him. Medhat, say hello.
Hi, everybody. Nice to meet you all.
Thank you. Nice to have you. I want to just say some things about Medhat. I've already listened to a few of his compositions that he sent over, and they are absolutely wonderful. And so I'm very excited to have him in the room tonight because we are going to learn a lot about composing, and it's not very often that you get this. So thank you so much, Medhat, for being here. Medhat is a composer based in Montreal, Canada. His training is in classical music since he was 4 years old. He studied pop and jazz composition and arrangement at Marie Victorin College, digital music at University of Montreal, and he has a master's in film scoring from Berklee Online. Some composing credits: Movement Deluxe, Season 2 and 3 in Teletoon Canada, Inside Lehman Brothers on BBC, The World According to Amazon on CBC, Oliver Gala on ICI Television, and The Secret Phases of the Moon, Montreal Planetarium. Arranging credits are Bobby Bazzini in Summer Is Gone Tour, and Genevieve Leclerc, Les Miserables, and The Voice Canada. Medhat, these are pretty impressive here. So Medhat, tell us how you got started a little more, and just let's go right into what you're going to share with us today.
Yeah, well, thank you for the intro. I started really, really young in music. You know, whatever I would get for Christmas, I would just not play with any toy unless it would make music. So, you know, that was the condition. If it made sound, I would play with it. No sound, I would just not even look at it. And I started piano lessons really, really young, from classical to pop to jazz. I just loved music overall. And I remember when Harry Potter came out, that was the first time I really noticed the music. I'm like, this is really cool music. And I really noticed the function that it was playing from a dramatic point of view and said, this is what I want to do when I grow up. And I remember buying the music sheets and playing all those themes on the piano. And from then, I started going to the library, listening to every single soundtrack I could get my hands on. I discovered a lot of composers like, you know, Max Steiner, Maurice Jarre, Bernard Herrmann, as well as more modern ones like Danny Elfman, John Williams, Hans Zimmer, and many others. So that's how I started getting an interest in that style of music. And obviously later on, I was lucky enough to have a teacher who basically his side gig was teaching, but his main gig was scoring films. His name is James Gelfand. And James basically taught me the ropes. How do you write the picture? And I worked with him, you know, assisted him on a few films, went to spotting sessions, learned all about post-production, how to sync to music. I started scoring films for students. And then from student films, got features. From features, got to television. And there we go. This is where I am today.
Nice. You know, we talk a lot about the network in the music industry. And you've just explained how this journey kind of happened for you in that you had someone who was, you know, kind of giving you work and being in the room. I've heard several composers talk about this. They go to work for a composer and before they know it, there they are doing scenes.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't writing for James. I'll be clear. All the music that James, he writes himself. I didn't ghostwrite for James. James always wrote his music, but I was there to take notes during spotting sessions. I was a bit the fly on the wall, and getting to see him, how he deals with notes, how he would fix stuff, that was very valuable.
I have a question for you. I know that you have a really good ear. I was wondering, when you want to go for a certain style and you have a reference, do you ever actually do an analysis of a written score to just go, okay, this is what they did here. I'm going to use this.
Yeah, well, I've trained my entire life to be able to to hear those things because I just can't afford to waste time looking up, like, is this score published or does someone that I know have the score? Let me open it and look at it. You got to be ready. I like to compare our jobs as firefighters. You're not going to test the waters once the fire starts. You have to be ready because once there's a fire, you need to react. So all the training you have to do prior, and you have to be ready, knowing the repertoire, knowing styles, and that obviously comes from studying different composers, of course. Mm-hmm. The more you listen to film music, the more you start understanding the aesthetics, and the more you look at scores, the more you learn orchestration tricks.
This is so valuable. You know, we have a lot of people who are artists who are learning to write for sync, but hearing it from the composer side is so interesting as well. There's so many more parts to what you do as a composer than sometimes we even realize.
Totally. Like one thing that I didn't touch upon was all the technical stuff. Like you need to be able to learn how to sync to picture. They don't cut the music, the film to our music. We synchronize our music to picture. If you have 24 frames, and if I'm doing a comedy or horror, if I'm two frames off, I literally ruined the sketch or jump scare. I have to be timed.
I was wondering, has it ever happened that somebody gave you the wrong frame rate?
So I'm not going to name the production, but it happened once on a TV project, and they were using 25 frames a second, and the cut that I had was 24. And when it played on television, I was able to access it, and I was horrified watching it. You know, by the end of the film, it was like 12 seconds off or something. It was absolutely horrible. And it was my fault. I should have asked the production to ask them, what is the frame rate? This is why you always ask for a time code, to make sure that your time code matches your session.
So interesting. Hey, Medad, on this note, I would like to play Trashy Friends, and then you can tell us how you had to accentuate movements. This was done for an animated film, and it won you first prize in Canada for best animated score. You mentioned a technique in your notes of Mickey Mousing. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So Mickey Mousing is when you're basically with music, every little thing that happens on screen, you're actually accentuating through music. For example, somebody walking, you might hear boom, 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 using pizzicato strings, for example. And that was due to Carl Stalling, because Carl Stalling, who did all those Warner Brothers, used to work for Disney back in the older days. So he was the guy who pioneered the system of bar sheets to sync the picture. Bar sheets was a system where they would, according to specific BPMs and then according to a frame rate, of course, it was a set of very complex mathematical calculations to do, pretty much, to be able to sync the picture.
Hi, Medhat. This is Phil here on the stage. Because of the choice of the sound palette, and I was curious, are those sound palettes ever likely to change, or is it because it's so inbred in us now? You know, all those instruments, they're so inbred with the cartoon now. Are we ever going to break away from that, or is it always going to be that orchestral palette, do you think?
No, it depends. It truly depends. I mean, look at scores like How to Train Your Dragon, the very modern orchestras. Look at what Randy Newman does on all the Pixar stuff like Monsters, Inc. and Toy Story. It depends on the style of the cartoon. In the case of Trashy Friends, it was explicitly Warner Brothers type of sound. I tried to modernize it by adding some guitars, for example, which wasn't necessarily part of the language. More explicit jazz sections that were also more modern, because otherwise you're just repeating the same thing over and over again.
I do have one question. I was wondering whether you've ever had to do your own Foley work, you know, whether a composer is expected to do that on top of composing.
No, I don't do Foley. It's, for me, it's a completely different job. It's like hiring your dentist to also do your open heart surgery. It's two completely different jobs.
Don't tell people that. Everyone, stop talking.
They make me do Foley, Medhat. That's why Jason's laughing at the moment. I love it. It is completely different. You're dead right. I totally agree.
It's two completely different jobs. And honestly, I strongly don't believe you can be amazing at both. Good at one and great at another. But great at both, I don't buy that. I don't care who the person is. I don't buy that. You're definitely stronger in one thing than the other if you're doing both.
I would love to listen to another track of Medhat's. Let's do Medhat. Could we do Time is Ticking?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, that is from a soundtrack from Real, a romantic comedy directed by Stephen Baxter that you scored a few years ago. Medhat, can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Totally. Yeah, this is an example of an underscore, not a theme. It doesn't really have a theme because there's dialogue and the music is just helping drive the tension. It's basically boy love girl. He's in school. He's looking at the girl that he loves. He wants to go say hi, but can't see her. He's very shy. He's like, no. And then time is ticking. He's looking at the clock. So there's all this tension that's being built. So they wanted something that sounded very Thomas Newman-y, you know, piano, bass, some Indian tablas. And this is the type of pal that I was instructed to use. I might have approached the scene differently, but that was my instruction from the director. So you got to write to work around dialogue, and the music shouldn't be taking too much space at the wrong place, if it makes any sense. So you got to find where you get bigger, where you get smaller. If you have a shot where it's very intimate, you get smaller. General, and when you're far away, you can get bigger. if there's dialogue, you get smaller. If there's an action scene, usually get bigger.
Mad Hat, I'm curious about a couple of things. Given, you know, all these projects, are you composing outside of your projects all the time, like kind of like a catalog that like singer-songwriters create where you have some variation in different sounding themed music that you can say audition your tracks for a particular job that might come up? And how are you making those connections to the directors? Are you basing your work off of pre-existing relationships that you've formed over time, or are you seeking out directors and films that you hear are coming up, or how do you do that?
Yeah, when it comes to for the first part, which is demos, some people do write their own stuff. I use stuff from projects that I've worked on in general. So my demo reel is always moving towards whatever direction I get thrown in. That said, if I get pigeonholed in one style, which I'm lucky not to have been pigeonholed yet, but if I become the horror composer or the thriller composer, mm-hmm. I might want to write different demos on purpose in different genres, just steer that away from that. That could be definitely done. As for the connections, it's all stuff that I've built over the years. It's either repeat connections, people that I've met and they called me again, mm-hmm. or people that I met and recommended me again. This is just the nature of the business. I can just say, oh, let me give you a gig. This is not how it works. Filmmakers, when they were working on their film, they've been working on it for at least 1 year. Sometimes it's 2, 3, 4 years. They've been facing all sorts of ups and downs. And usually we get brought in, we have about 2 months, 6 to 8 weeks in general to score a feature film. So you can't just hire anybody. They will hire people they know and people that have solid track record, basically, because the wrong music could completely ruin a scene. Think of a romantic scene and add circus music to it and see how ridiculous it gets. And honestly, like, the more I work, the more I get detailed OCD about the smallest things that I didn't necessarily notice when I started out.
I guess you also get to know the things certain directors tend to like.
Yeah. My friend Priscilla, I've been working with her for almost 11 years now. And we got to the point where she just gives me her film. She says, just do it. And I can hear her voice in my head saying, I don't like that. Like, I know her so much. We've worked together for 11 years. That's the tricky part. You get, when you're working with someone you don't know, you quickly need to be able to read the room and mm-hmm. understand what they're allergic to, what they're not allergic to, et cetera, et cetera.
And my one other question, when you are scoring a film, do you kind of start with a theme, say a key kind of piece of music that becomes like associated with a character, and then you try to build off of that theme throughout?
Yeah, absolutely. This is this technique is called leitmotifs. And this is something that I use all the time. It's a very effective trick. It's been used since Wagner's times in the 1800s. Definitely. It's a very effective technique. And reusing the theme and transforming it. If it's in major, you can play it in minor. If it's in 4-4, you can play it in 5-4, 3-4. Play it slow, play it fast. Just play the harmony. There's so many ways of reusing material, but also having it unconsciously affect what people perceive of the character.
Those questions are also good. We don't have enough time in this room today to do everything. We're going to have him back. But Mad Hat, I want to listen to another one called Boarding the Train.
Yeah, totally. This piece is recorded with a live orchestra. This is recorded with a Budapest orchestra, the same orchestra that played on Parasite and Star Wars Rebels. It's only all the strings are live. Everything else is in MIDI. And this is a great example of a hybrid solution where you're working with part virtual instruments, part real instruments.
Mad Hat, so tell us about why you could hire that orchestra. I mean, I want to go into you talking about your budgets. So please tell us how this happens.
So budgeting for a film is always the tricky part. Usually we're working with package deals. So it's usually the easiest way for producers to handle. So basically the first discussion you can have with them is like, okay, what type of score are you looking for? Do you want to go piano and synthesizers? Do you want to go full orchestra? Do you want to go electronic? And according to the type of score, then you have to say to yourself, okay, what can I afford? How many minutes of music can I do in the computer? And how many minutes of music require real players? Because with all the technology that we have, that's great. Nothing replaces live musicians. And I'm always advocating to get live players on my project as much as I can. I have cut my salaries a few times, actually, on some of the projects just to get more players. Nothing replaces the human performance. When you're working with a virtual instrument, it looks great, but it's still an imitation of a real thing.
Exactly. So, I mean, I feel sometimes, as I was saying earlier, the MIDI is getting so much better and the instruments and the virtual things. But what you just said, the emotion of it, sometimes you just so feel that, especially in the strings.
Yeah, and it's also, there's X amount of variations that you can get when you're working with a musician. You have unlimited variations. Also, I'm not an expert in every instrument. I know every instrument as much as I can, but nothing replaces someone who actually knows different techniques to play it and how to express it. This is why I really think live players will always be necessary. Now, you have to ask yourself, what cost do you have to work with? For example, if it's a union gig, let's say you're doing a studio film, you will have to work with unions. It's a studio gig, you might, you know, a 3-hour session, not more than 15 minutes, 30 minute break, pension. If then somebody's doubling on different instruments, their salary will change, obviously, according to that. You will be required to have a concert master, you'll have a contractor, you'll have a conductor. There's a lot of rules to play by. If it's a non-union gig, it's different situation. So every project, sometimes I have no choice but to go non-union, because in my contract, it's written, I am forbidden to use union musicians. So it's not because I don't want to do AFM, just because my contract forbid me from hiring unions, pretty much. Once you know that, then you ask yourself, okay, with those conditions, how many musicians can I afford? And then from there, you ask yourself, okay, how many minutes of music? Realistically, 3 hours, you can get up to 15 minutes of music in a 3-hour session. 45 minutes, well, those are three sessions. Three sessions, okay, do I cram them in one day? I do three for a 10-hour day, for example. Or do I do 2 days? You'll see how many days you can rent the studio for. If you're working with live players, you have the orchestrators, copyist, you have the mixer, the engineer, your assistants. So there's a lot of things that get involved once you get live players. You're working with human beings, and there's all the logistics that comes with it.
Medat, I've learned so much today of the process, and weren't even able to get to so many other things. So I'm sure we're going to have you back and talk more about demo reels and gear. And we didn't get into that today, but your music is wonderful.
I don't know if I could be heard. I've jumped on my phone. I think my phone connection might be better. But like John saying, man, amazing to have you in the room tonight to listen to your music, to listen to the process. Thank you, Medat.
Thank you so much for having me. I'd be happy to come back.
Thank you so much to our amazingly talented guests for joining us on today's show, and to you, our listeners, for spending your time listening to us and being with us. The Sync Report cast will be back in a week with your hosts, myself, Colin O'Donoghue, Rose Ganguza, and Jason P. Rothberg. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.